His teeth flashed. It wasn't a smile, it was more like a snarl. But she controlled herself, and her lips quickly closed into a thin line.
Excellent. That's exactly what I would have done. Please move your unit off the bridge except for the tech. I've already sent our best people to help. They'll take over. With any luck, we'll turn the ship away from the star.
Moving out, sir,
Graves said. After that, we were hustling down long, damaged passageways. Worried-looking techs hurried past us going the other way. They looked at the floating dead and frozen sprays of blood apprehensively. I hoped, for all our sakes, they could repair the ship's systems before it was too late. Chapter 10 Natasha was a good tech. Too good. She'd called it down to the hour. By the time the rest of the techs agreed, we only had 13 precious hours left before we slammed into the local star. It was already getting hotter aboard ship. Fortunately, we'd started off somewhere around negative 200 degrees Celsius. Now that we were moving closer and closer to the central star, the temperature was naturally rising. At first, this would feel good. But in the end, we'd burn up. There was nothing that the techs could do to change our course. The aliens had been very thorough, and from all indications, the sabotage had been deliberate.
It makes a strange sort of sense, I told Carlos later when we reached the mess hall.
How's that?
We'd taken showers, been issued new inner smart cloth suits by the dispensers, and then been sent clanking along the passageways in full armor to get some chow while we could. We still had no idea how the brass was going to handle the situation. I didn't think they did either.
They attacked the ship as suddenly as they could, I said. They took Corvos out fast and scuttled it. Maybe they figured the Galactics would never find out what happened, and they'd get away with this violation.
You think that makes sense? Demanded Carlos with a nervous laugh. None of this makes any sense. It's crazy. The squids are crazy, and our officers are crazier. Together they'll get us all permed in the end. You watch.
What do you mean? Carlos put down his fork, which had a chunk of pork and beans on the end. At least, the food had been pressed into the general shape, color, and texture of pork and beans. They hadn't quite gotten the taste right, unfortunately. He leaned close to me and spoke in a rough whisper.
I mean, my challenged friend, that it's frigging obvious what we should do. We have to abandon ship. And just let Corvus crash into the star?
Carlos shrugged.
Better than letting us all die.
I've got a better idea, I said. We should revive the Skrull and give them a shot at repairing the ship. After all, it's their vessel. Carlos had picked up his fork again. He waved it at me admonishingly.
There you go, thinking up high crimes again.
Doing something to save yourself can't be a crime.
Ha, sure it can, dumbass.
According to Carlos, if they ever put my brain into a monkey's skull, the monkey would walk backwards. His natural personality was often amusing, but not when I was stressed. I struggled with an urge to throw my pork and beans into his face. If I thought it would get him to shut up, I'd have done it. The miserable food wouldn't have been a big loss. When I'd controlled my thoughts of vengeance, I took a deep breath and asked him what he meant.
We're talking about the Galactics and the Nerbs,
he said.
The ultimate in government bureaucrats. As far as they're concerned, you can be dead and still legally perform a capital crime while you're sitting in your grave.
I thought it over, knowing he had a point. I see what you mean. We don't have a license to use our machines on the Skrull. They haven't licensed the technology for themselves either. It still seems wrong that we can't use machines we have on hand to fix our dire situation.
There's more to it than that, Carlos said. Let's say we're willing to chance an imperial crime for the sake of a few of these monkey turtles. We can't do it anyway. Their bodies have never been scanned, never been backed up.
I leaned closer to him for a second.
I heard from some of the bio people we could still do it. With a dead body as a model, one that's flash frozen, you can get a reading and copy them.
All you'd have to do is edit out the cellular damage. Just think about it. Most of them were turned into popsicles when the squids opened the hull.
Carlos looked at me in concern.
Tell Anne Grant not to try it. Stay away from her, or together you two will mix up an entirely new stew of crazy and get Earth erased this time.
I frowned and started eating my food. Carlos was right in his assumptions, and that bothered me. The bio I'd talked to was indeed Anne. She was someone who I knew from experience was willing to go out of her way and even break serious rules to save lives. She was probably the most likely person on the ship to violate a galactic law. Besides me, that is. What bothered me most was knowing that if Carlos could figure out Anne was behind the crime, others could figure it out too.
Listen, Carlos said. The Skrull are all dead. Leave them that way. Focus on the living.
What about the colonists? I asked. There are humans in this system somewhere, and we should be helping them.
Helping them? Carlos snorted. We're here to exterminate them, remember? That's why Turov was so happy. Her problem solved itself when those stupid squids attacked us.
I ignored him after that. I liked Carlos, and he was a good man to have in a trench with you. But he was the kind who could easily write off anyone who wasn't in his immediate vicinity. He'd risk his life to save a friend, but people a kilometer away who he didn't know personally would just have to fend for themselves. That wasn't the way my mind and heart operated. As a soldier from Earth, I felt a need to protect all humans. I could probably get attached to an alien race, too, if I spent enough time around them. I don't know. Chow time was over all too soon. We were sent to the armory next, and this had me worried. My suspicions were confirmed when our orders came in.
Follow the arrows to yellow deck. Find your unit's embarking station. Do not vary or stray from the path. Stay with your units and do not stop for extra gear.
A private contact came in from Adjunct Leeson shortly after that.
McGill, you fully operational?
Yes, sir.
Good. When you board the lifter, park your butt next to mine.
Will do, Adjunct.
I was breathing hard during the short jog past green deck, then past blue. We were going all the way down to yellow deck where the lifters were stored when in warp. None of this sounded good to me. Carlos contacted me helmet to helmet as we jogged.
What the hell is happening? He demanded. I saw your comm light flash. Who's talking to you? What are they saying?
Isn't it obvious?
I asked.
We're going on a little jog to digest that lovely meal.
You're such a dick, Carlos complained. How is our destination a state secret? Don't even try to stonewall me, McGill. There's no point.
I kind of agreed with him. It looked to me like we were abandoning the ship, and if that was the case, it hardly mattered if the rank and file heard about it or not. Legion Varus didn't believe in briefing their troops on details. They figured we weren't the most obedient bunch, and keeping us in the dark was their way of keeping us from giving them trouble.
We're abandoning ship, if I had to guess, I said.
Abandoning ship? To where? What about our stuff? Damn!
I snorted. Not 10 minutes ago, he'd been complaining that they hadn't ordered us all to jump ship, and now that it was happening, he had fresh complaints. That was Carlos in a nutshell. Another thought occurred to me as we jogged down passages under flashing lights following yellow arrows. Yellow meant we were in a possible combat situation. I guess that fit.
That's why they aren't telling us, I told Carlos.
What?
They don't want you loading up on personal effects. We're carrying full combat kits, and that's it. We'll board the lifters, and we'll be flying as light as possible. That's got to be it.
The more I thought about it, the more obvious it seemed. Why not come over the voice net and give us a pep speech about why we had to move to the lifters and exit the ship? Why hustle us to the airlocks without much more than a final quick meal? Because they didn't want us to get any ideas, that's why. I explained my thinking to Carlos.
What bastards, Carlos said with feeling. That makes too much sense. I had a lot of stuff in my locker, private stuff, you know?
Yeah, stolen vid files and that weird collection of hair from the girl's shower drain, right?
Screw you, McGill.
I chuckled, and he finally stopped pestering me on the private line. We went down the null grav tubes directly, diving head first and pulling ourselves along the rungs on the walls. They weren't even bothering with having us use the lifts. I passed veteran Harris at a junction. He took time to shout, "Go, go!" into everyone's faceplate as we passed, while whacking the back of each trooper's helmet. As a heavy trooper with a thick helmet, I could barely feel the impact of his gauntlet as it crashed into the back of my head, but it did create a ringing clang I could have done without.
"What's the bloody hurry, vet?"
Carlos demanded. Harris didn't strike him again, as I'd halfway been expecting. His face looked a little worried.
"Don't know, just orders. Get the hell to the first seat you find and strap your ass in. They aren't going to give you more than 30 seconds to stow your gear. Expect a hot release and drop."
Those words surprised me. A hot release and drop? Were we under attack? I couldn't figure it out. We still had more than 10 hours before we reached the star's corona, the point of no return for all spaceships. After the long, jouncing run, I was rewarded with a small aperture to pass through. It was a small hatchway on top of the lifter we all had to wriggle through. Normally, the lifters were loaded one at a time in the bays designated for the purpose, but that part of the procedure had apparently been skipped this time. We were boarding through the top hatch because it would save time. I opened a private channel to Natasha as I boarded and clanked down the ranks of huddled soldiers. Most of the troops on the lifter were heavies, as this was a heavy cohort. But the row I was passing by was populated by auxiliary troops, bio people, techs, and other support personnel. They were in their pajamas, as we called smart cloth uniforms. They eyed me in quiet concern as I crashed by them. Most people didn't like to mess with heavy weaponeers. We had bad reps, lots of body armor, and like me, we were generally the biggest guys in the unit. The only reaction I got from most of them as I passed was a desperate effort to pull back feet so I wouldn't stomp on them too hard. My tube thumped into more than one unfortunate's ribs, and they glared at me, suspecting I was bullying them. In truth, it was hard to maneuver quickly in heavy armor with a full kit without slamming into everyone as I passed them. It took me a while to find the seat I was supposed to sit in. Adjunct Leeson requested me to sit by his side, and I wasn't going to skip that invitation. I had a lot of questions about this entire exercise, and he might have answers. I finally sighted Leeson with an open seat on his left. He waved me forward impatiently. I moved forward with purpose. A girl's foot strayed, and I smashed it flat.
"Ow, you jackass!" raged the owner.
She rubbed her foot and glared up at me. She was blonde with a sharp nose and quick-moving eyes that reminded me of an excited bird. "Sorry, miss," I had time to say. And then, the world turned upside down. Almost before I knew what was happening, I was lifted up and kicked down the row of seats. I could have sworn that Harris had finally lost patience with me and given me a boot in the rear. But Harris had long ago found a seat and strapped in. I fell forward, armor sparking, plasma tube banging into helmets and knees as I hung onto it. The lifter was moving. We'd been dropped from the guts of Corvus and released into space. Normally, launch wouldn't have initiated a series of violent maneuvers, but our pilot wasn't screwing around. The second we were down and out in open space, she'd gunned the lifter. I could imagine the plume of exhaust we were leaving behind us in space. Wherever we were going, we were doing it in a big damned hurry. A gauntlet reached down and grabbed me by the air hose as I slid by. Fortunately, the hose didn't pop out. Leeson hauled me up into the jump seat next to him.
"Quit screwing around, McGill," he said.
I strapped in as fast as I could. "Sorry, sir. Just couldn't pass up the opportunity to have a little fun."
"Does your tube still work?"
I checked it quickly. "Passes all diagnostics."
"Good," he said. "I have the feeling we're going to need it."
"Sir, could you clarify a few things for me?" Leeson was a balding man with small, dark eyes. He gave me a hard stare.
"I guess it can't hurt now. We're already underway."
"Thank you, sir."
"We're abandoning Corvus," he told me.
I almost rolled my eyes at him, but I controlled the urge.
"That makes sense, Adjunct," I said. "But why the hurry?"
I thought we had at least 10 hours to go.
Yeah, sure, we had 10 hours before we reached the critical point of no return and got sucked into the star. But did you stop to think about our position in this system? Once the decision was made to jump, we realized we had to move as fast as possible.
I frowned. So we have another ship we're trying to rendezvous with?
This amused Leeson.
Right, sure, he laughed. They're like 50 luxury cruise ships from the core systems hanging around out here circling this shithole frontier star in case the lost troop ships happened by.
I take that as a no, sir.
A big no, specialist. We jumped off Corvus because the only place to run to consists of a few scrubby planets. Two of those are in the Goldilocks zone. We're aiming for those worlds and we couldn't wait any longer.
After he said this, the race to get off the ship made more sense. I knew enough planetary astronomy to know that the Goldilocks zone was the region of space around a star in which liquid water could exist on a planet's surface. Earth was in that zone, as were almost all inhabited worlds.
I get it, sir, I said. The only place we could run to consisted of the local planets that are inhabitable. We'll need air and water to survive.
Exactly.
So I'm assuming we're making planetfall on that ocean planet the colonists were sent 2 years back, right?
Adjunct Leeson shook his head.
No, afraid not. That was considered and rejected.
Why?
I asked, my heart sinking. I'd been entertaining visions of warm oceans and even warmer beaches.
Where do you think those damn squids came from?
Leeson asked me. I thought about it. They did seem to be aquatic, at least originally.
But are we sure they're native to this system at all?
Leeson lost patience with my battery of questions. He'd never been a patient man. Competent, yes. Calm and collected, no.
Look, he said. I have no idea why they decided to bail out and head for the dust world instead of the water world. And I didn't order you to plant your butt next to mine so we could have this little bedtime chat either. You're here for one reason.
He pointed at my plasma tube.
I want that, he said, indicating my weapon. I want you and your weapon as close as possible to my position. From what I've heard, only heavy weapons damage these squid things, and you've already had combat experience with them.
That's true, sir. Just one more thing.
What?
You said something about a dust world?
Yeah, he said. The brass looked at all their options and narrowed them down to three. One was to try to invade the water world. That idea was dropped because those oceans are probably teeming with massive squids. The second idea was to hang around space and broadcast an SOS. That was rejected, too, as the enemy would doubtlessly hear the signal and come to wipe us out, assuming we could even survive in open space long enough to be rescued in the first place. Fortunately, there's another world in the Goldilocks zone in this system.
Dust world. It had a certain ring to it, I had to admit. Unfortunately, the name conjured up a vivid image, an image I didn't like in the slightest.
Sir, what's this dust world place like, if you don't mind my asking? I've been kind of hoping to take a bath, if you know what I mean.
Look, he snapped. It's a friggin' rocket space, okay? A dry rock with a little air, a little water, and a whole lot of dust. Maybe if you're lucky, you'll get to make mud when we land, and you can take a bath in that. Now shut up. I'm listening in on command chat.
I fell silent and endured the G's as the lifter maneuvered and rocked. I had time to ponder my choices in life, and I had to admit, I was full of regrets today. Chapter 11. A banging sound on my helmet made me open one eye. I'd been sleeping, which wasn't easy to do in heavy armor aboard a lifter. Adjunct Leeson's face stared into mine. Our visors were open, but we'd kept our helmets on. That was SOP in dangerous systems.
Sir? Let's go. I'm supposed to move forward and attend a briefing. You're coming with.
I didn't argue. I removed the straps and got to my feet, groaning. The internal joints of metal armor always created sore spots that dug into my flesh and cut off circulation. I was all but dragging my left leg behind me as I set off after the adjunct. We traveled to an open ladder and hauled ourselves upward. The hatch at the top was tight for a weaponeer, and my kit scraped and banged as I slipped through. On the upper deck, things looked different. Very different. I'd never been anywhere on the lifter other than down inside the troop pods. The upper decks were reserved for the crew and the higher-ranking passengers. The deck we stepped onto wasn't as big as the lower troop bays, but when compared with the rows of bare metal jump seats, it was luxuriously appointed. There were swiveling chairs with actual cushions. These seats even had armrests with cup holders attached to them. Leeson directed me to an out-of-the-way chair with a wave of his gauntlet. I settled into it happily, even though my thick armor kept me from enjoying the upholstery. Centurion Graves was there, as were a lot of other adjuncts and centurions. Leading the conversation was Primus Turov. She strutted around a central planning table and gave everyone the evil eye. My visor was up, but I kept my face well back inside my helmet. I hoped she wouldn't recognize me.
"Let's get started," Turov said.
The rest of them stopped talking and took seats. There weren't enough to go around, and some of them had to stand. I felt self-conscious, but didn't want to move from my seat in the back. Adjunct Leeson had ordered me to sit there. That was my story, and I was going to stick to it. There were a few other non-coms in the room, but I was the only weaponeer. The others were veterans, along with a few techs. The techs operated the planning table by working on their hands and knees around it, coaxing the system into displaying graphics that showed our position. I looked for Natasha among them, but I didn't see her. On the planning table, our small fleet of lifters resembled a school of tiny green fish, traveling in a slow orbit around the central star. The target world was represented by a burnt orange ball. It didn't look to me like we had far to go.
"Here's the good news," Turov said. "We're going to make planetfall soon. There's no question of that. There's no sign of pursuits, either. The enemy fleet, if even we have one, isn't intercepting us. What we're here to do now is decide where on this Garden of Eden we're going to land."
Adjunct Toro, a woman who'd never liked me since we'd first laid eyes on one another, raised her hand.
"What is it, adjunct?"
Turov asked her.
"Sir, is this really the only choice we have? Just about anything looks preferable." "I agree," Turov said. "I argued all along that our top choice was to bail out and stay in the space lane to see if the techs aboard Corvus could pull a miracle and regain control of the ship. In fact, I wanted to put all our technical people on their task, but the Tribune felt it was too risky. He believes the enemy might be waiting to finish the job by ambushing us in space."
I frowned as I listened to her talk. I gathered from her statements that there were still techs aboard Corvus. The idea was alarming. People were on that ship, sailing into the star, still trying to fix it. If so, they had only a few hours left to live. I checked the local roster of contacts on my tapper, and my heart sank. Natasha wasn't on the lifter with me. That could only mean she'd been left behind on Corvus. I didn't want to think about how that was going to end for her. Adjunct Toro seemed to be thinking along the same lines I was.
"But, sir," she said, "would it be wise to lose even more people in what's likely to be a fireball at the end?"
Centurion Graves stirred. He was one of the ones who'd been left standing. Turov signaled for him to speak.
"No one is going to get permed on Corvus," Graves said. "Not unless we all die. We copied their data to the lifters. If Corvus crashes into the star, we'll record the fact, then revive them after we land on the target planet."
This assurance seemed to settle everyone down. I was still alarmed, however. I couldn't stop thinking about Natasha. Things might be awful right now for her aboard that doomed ship. The techs we'd left behind were all sailing directly into a blazing star, knowing they'd been abandoned with nothing to look forward to other than cooking to death. The radiation alone would probably finish them before they felt the terrible heat.
"Now, back to the matter at hand,"
Turov continued.
"Let's take a look at this rock we're supposed to land on. For the most part, it's a giant desert. There are a few places where life has been detected. deep gullies exist, valleys that are essentially cracks in the surface of an endless expanse of blowing grit. Inside these valleys, water runs, and the shade keeps the plants from burning up. By our best projections, the shaded regions are similar to tropical oases.
Turov proceeded to display the world on the planning table and show these rifts in the surface. Some were over 30 kilometers long, as wide as 3 kilometers, and nearly as deep as they were wide.
The valleys we're most interested in are those clustered around the southern pole. We've identified 10 of them, one for each lifter, as landing zones. These valleys are sheltered from the sun and suitably temperate.
The briefing went on while I stared in fascination. I realized I was about to land on an unexplored world, and perhaps be one of the first humans in history to breathe its air. I found that exciting, but it seemed like a wearisome chore to the rest of the assembled officers. Most of them were veterans of many campaigns on alien planets. In time, the group settled on a green valley close to the pole itself. Due to the angle of the planet, the bottom of this gully was never in the direct sunlight. Our cohort's techs assured us the temperature would be quite comfortable and possibly even cool at night.
We don't have a lot of time to find a suitable region where we can bivouac and survive until help comes,
Turov explained.
The Tribune ordered us all to choose a different valley, one for each cohort on each lifter, and to land there when we make planetfall. Once we're down, we'll explore, compare notes, and report in. The plan is to decide which of these holes in the desert is the most suitable, and to gather all our people at that spot.
I could hardly believe what I was hearing. We were breaking up the lifters, each of which carried a single cohort. What if the enemy was down there waiting for us? We thought the squids came from the water world, but we could be wrong. Several Centurions moved about uncomfortably, but no one said anything. Finally, Centurion Graves cleared his throat.
Yes,
asked the Primus.
Primus, this seems like a poor strategy. Spreading our forces around the moment we land will weaken us if we meet resistance.
She nodded.
You're right, but we don't have much time. We're not going to engage the aliens if we meet up with them. We'll cut our losses and fly out. Dead troops will be counted and revived later.
What's the hurry, sir?
Graves asked. Turov worked her lips thoughtfully, as if considering how she would answer the question.
We don't have much in the way of supplies, Centurion. Actually, we've got almost nothing. We don't even have enough water to last a month. We depended on Corvus for that sort of thing. And we had to leave the ship suddenly to make planetfall as we passed this world. We know nothing about this planet, but we're going to have to find a suitable spot to hole up until we are rescued. We can explore faster by splitting up.
Several others, emboldened by Graves' success, raised their own hands to ask questions. I wanted to join them, but didn't dare. Primus Turov lifted her own hands in a calming gesture. She looked worried.
I know. You have 1,000 questions. Let me give you a couple of facts instead. First, we need breathable air, potable water, and hopefully a food source. We need them right now. Second, we might all be ambushed. We might even lose a lifter or two full of troops. But we've got the recorders running, and we'll capture all deaths as they occur. Any group that gets wiped out will be revived at one of the other camps. Problem solved.
I was stunned. That was just the sort of thinking that Legion Varus was famous for. If he didn't make it, they shrugged and made a copy. Centurion Graves asked one more question.
How long will we have to wait on this rock, Primus? When can we expect a rescue?
Indeterminate. The Galactics are aware of this renegade frontier system. When Corvus doesn't come home, the loss will be reported. I would expect we'll have to wait no more than a year until another Skrull ship comes to investigate. Hopefully they'll come before the Galactic Battle Fleet arrives. the warships may not bother to distinguish between legitimate castaways and feral local aliens.
As I heard this, my heart sank. Was I really about to spend a year on a desolate rock in space with no assurance that there would be a rescue in the end? I couldn't help but think about the events that would transpire when the Galactics finally arrived. It was quite possible, I knew, that by the time the battle fleet darkened the skies of Dust World, I'd have survived by scraping along for years, only to be blasted to component atoms by a heartless maelstrom of interstellar ships. The questions finally stopped, and the group got down to the business of choosing a target valley. Turov made sure we all voted twice to choose the best possible option. In my opinion, she talked for too long. I was getting bored. We couldn't really make the best choice from such limited data anyway. The officers finally chose the biggest valley up around the southern pole. But after Turov selected it on the map, she quickly discovered it had been taken by another cohort. Then she selected our second choice, tapping at the screen. The computer map flicked orange, refusing to take the input. Frowning, Primus Turov became alarmed.
"Those bastards," she muttered.
She quickly tapped at each of the other major valleys, one at a time. All of them had already been taken. There were 10 cohorts in our legion, and apparently the rest of them had chosen their destinations first and talked it to death afterward. Turov scanned the map, scrolling it this way and that. Finally, she found a small valley farther north than any of the others. I knew this place would be hotter as it was closer to the equator, but it registered as deep and wet.
"It's a crater, not a true valley," Turov said. "It's basically a deep lake with a sizable scrim of land around it. The sensors say it's circular, 4 kilometers deep and about 6 wide. I guess it will have to do."
I stared at the screen as her fingers stabbed down. The outline of the valley turned green, indicating the selection had been accepted. Adjunct Leeson walked over to me as the meeting broke up and gave me a grim smile.
"Welcome to your new hole in the ground, McGill."
"Looks like home sweet home to me," I said.
"Now here's the deal. When we deploy, I want you right next to me. You understand that?"
"Yes, sir."
"Any questions?"
"Just one, sir. Why did you bring me up here to this briefing?"
"I wanted you to know the score."
"But why?
You could have just briefed me later."
Adjunct Leeson's eyes slid around the room. After he was satisfied no one was listening in, he leaned closer to me.
"These crazy squid aliens of yours are down there waiting for us. I'm going to have you and your big gun front and center."
"That sounds like a real privilege, Adjunct."
Leeson snorted. "I'm not out to screw you over. You remember Cankri 9, when the lizards had trapped us at the spaceport?"
"I sure do. It wasn't our legion's finest hour."
"No, it wasn't," he said. "But it was your finest hour. You outlasted everyone. I like a man who can survive the worst a planet can throw at him. That's the kind of magic I want near me. I figured if you were here at the briefing, it might give you an edge."
I nodded, finally catching on. "You want to live no matter what. Is that it? That kind of attitude is almost unpatriotic in Legion Varus. Why not trust one of the other cohorts to revive us if things go wrong?"
"I don't trust my own mother when the blood begins to spray," he said. "But I trust a good weaponeer."
"Thank you, sir. I'll try to be worthy of your confidence." Adjunct Leeson shook his head and chuckled.
"Don't thank me until you hear the punchline. Our squad drew the short straw. We're stepping off this lifter first."
My face fell. "How exactly did that happen, sir?"
"Centurion Graves volunteered us."
My eyes swung to Graves. Leeson's did the same. We both stared at the Centurion grimly, but he didn't seem to care. He was having a private talk with Turov. "You think he's over there volunteering us for some more special duties?" I asked. "Like repainting the lifter's hull after we land?"
Adjunct Leeson laughed. "I wouldn't put it past him."
Chapter 12. About a dozen hours later, the lifter bounced through the upper atmosphere of the target world, jolting me awake. All around me, troopers looked worried and a little green. In the center of the aisle, between two rows of seated troops, was a vacuum-powered drain. When someone popped open their faceplate and leaned forward to puke, the drain turned on, whirring. It always seemed to know when there was work to be done. The rest of us tried not to watch. Vomit could become contagious during a rough re-entry. The pilot began to relay vid feeds from outside the ships to our helmets. I selected the input and displayed it inside my faceplate. The vid was distracting, for which I was grateful, but it wasn't comforting. The arid planet we were hurtling toward was big and windy, but we couldn't feel that wind yet. We were just below the exosphere now and falling down into the thermosphere. Outside the ship, there was nothing to speak of in the way of breathable air at this point, and only enough gravity to pull the puke gently toward the drain under our metal boots. But there was enough gas outside the lifter to bump us around. We hung on grimly, not talking much. What was there to say? We'd land, then we'd get out and fight if we had to. I don't think anyone knew what we were getting ourselves into, not even the Primus herself. Watching the vids, I saw snakes of dust crawling over endless dunes. I couldn't see any of the tropical valleys we were supposed to be targeting. What I did see was a constant parade of sandstorms rolling over the desolate landscape. We began powering down and heating up with friction as we punched through layer after layer of the atmosphere. It never seemed to smooth out the way it did at the end back on Earth. I checked the surface temperature and sighed. It was about 50 degrees Celsius down there. Carlos beeped my helmet. I answered his call reluctantly. "What?" I demanded. "Have you been checking out the travel brochure? Looks pretty sweet, doesn't it?" "Maybe, if you're some kind of desert scorpion." Carlos laughed. "Just like home," he said. "The Sahara Desert, that is. Highs in the upper 50s with bags of sunshine. Wish you were here." I had no idea what he was talking about, but I didn't complain. Carlos often dealt with stressful situations by making jokes, even if they didn't make much sense. 5 long minutes later, the lifter heaved and then came to a final thumping stop. It felt like someone had hit the bottom of my boots and the seat of my armor with a hammer all at the same time.
"At least they didn't make us jump out,"
Adjunct Leeson complained next to me. We slapped off the buckles and got to our feet. At least everyone in my squad did. The rest sat there watching us. 30 troops took 30 seconds to arrange their gear, and then a huge grinding sound began. We all looked toward the exit ramp. A brilliant glare of light was expected, but we didn't see that. Instead, I saw a cool, gloomy light. It was almost purple, the shade of twilight before the last rays of the sun are extinguished and night takes over. "What's the temp out there?" I asked Carlos, who was still on a private line to my helmet.
30°C, he said. "Can that be right? That's, like, reasonable."
I didn't have time to answer him. Leeson gave me a rude shove from behind. The servos and the auto-balancing systems of my suit whined in protest.
"Get moving, McGill. We'll be right behind you."
I pushed past the other troopers who were all heavies in armor. My metal scratched theirs, leaving white lines on the burnished surfaces, but no one complained. They'd heard the adjunct's order, and no one wanted to take my place. I marched down the ramp with my tube set for a long-distance shot with a narrow energy spread. I figured there probably weren't going to be aliens waiting on the ground for us. It would probably take them a while to get to the landing site, even if they'd been watching us come down. When I came out of the bottom of the lifter and saw my surroundings, I was taken by surprise. The land was beautiful, not harsh and ugly as I'd expected. I'd been visualizing a desert, but instead what met my gaze were 1,000 lush-looking plants. They weren't quite like plants from home, but you could tell they were full of water and life. Most of them looked like some kind of huge flower. Thick stalks led up to massive growths that came in a riot of colors. Under the stalks of each plant was a spray of meaty-looking blue-green leaves. These leaves, stalks, and even the flowers themselves all looked like they had a waxy coating on them. Maybe it was just their natural texture. I couldn't be sure. Whatever they were, I knew I wasn't going to be the first guy to touch one or, God forbid, eat one. The bio people would have to run a load of tests before anyone dared to do that. Besides the towering flowers all around the ship, there wasn't much else to see other than the canyon walls that surrounded us. Far, far above was a vast circle of glaring yellow light. The circle wasn't the star, however. It was only the hazy sky of the surface world, filled with dust. I was looking up from the bottom of a deep hole in the planet's crust. Behind me I heard clanking footsteps. The rest of the squad was on the ramp coming down to join me. We took up defensive firing positions among the flowers, but there didn't seem to be any need.
"No trees?" Carlos complained. "What kind of jungle has no trees?"
"An alien one," I answered.
"What's that, McGill?" Leeson demanded. "Report, specialist."
"Sorry, sir, nothing here. No enemy contact, no sign of civilization. There's nothing out here other than some really, really big orchids."
"Good."
Leeson finally appeared at my side along with veteran Harris. Had they been hiding inside the ship at the top of the ramp?
"Nice of you two to join the party," I said. "Pick a flower, we have plenty."
"Keep your eyes on the horizon, McGill," Harris said.
I turned back to the scene encircling the ship. I couldn't see much. I noticed there was a fine layer of silt on the ground. It must filter down from the sky overhead all the time. Carlos opened his faceplate. I think he was probably the first.
"Air checks out," he said when he saw us staring at him. "It tastes a little dusty, but all my monitors say it's breathable."
Harris, Leeson, and I kept our faceplates closed. We watched Carlos closely, and I knew we were all wondering when he might keel over. Sure, the atmospheric sensors were glowing green, but they didn't always pick up airborne toxins. Carlos investigated the environment while Leeson called down the next squad. He loudly claimed we'd secured the perimeter. I didn't think we'd done any such thing, but I kept my mouth shut.
"These leaves are waxy and coated with mucus," Carlos said, faintly disgusted.
Ann Grant came down to investigate.
"That's sap," she said.
She had her faceplate up, too, and I privately thought they were both crazy.
"Sap," Carlos said. "Green plant blood? I don't think so."
Specialist Grant investigated further.
"You have a point. It seems to be moving over the plant, flowing downward. Look what happens when I let some dirt fall on this leaf."
We watched her experiment, but I tried to keep my eyes on the cliff walls, which were alarmingly close.
"I'm developing a theory," Anne said, sounding excited. "This waxy, sticky coating flowing over the plant is an adaptation designed to protect it."
"Protect it against what?"
asked Carlos, yanking his gauntlet back and rubbing it on his armored legs.
"I'm not saying it's poisonous. The coating defends these growths against the endless sifting dust that falls from above. It looks like the wet lining of your throat and sinuses, carrying away debris."
"What the hell for?" asked Carlos.
"There can't be much rain here, and they only get reflected light from the walls of the canyon. The water all comes from underground. If the dust constantly falls and covers their leaves, the plants must have trouble with photosynthesis. If the leaves become too dusty, they die. So they've developed a way to filter the dust away."
"That's an excellent theory, Grant,"
Centurion Graves said, joining the conversation.
"But I don't really give a damn about the plant life. What we need to know is if we're alone down here."
"Sir, you'll have to scout the area for that."
Centurion Graves turned to Leeson.
"Take a squad north. The central lake has to lie in that direction. I'll have Adjunct Toro go in the opposite direction to locate the canyon wall. If you find anything useful or dangerous, report in."
"Said Leeson, "what about the rest of the cohort?"
I'll give the all clear and we'll disembark. I think it's pretty obvious we didn't land in the middle of an ambush. Our core force will set up camp around the lifter to defend it.
Grumbling, Leeson led Veteran Harris, me, and the rest of the squad northward. The adjunct seemed to be in a sour mood.
Graves must have an in for Leeson,
Carlos told me quietly. I bet his dog crapped all over the Centurion's lawn back on Earth. Carlos's idea made me smile, but I didn't think he was right. Graves didn't need a reason to order a man to die, he just did it out of habit. If he thought your death was a good idea, you might as well accept what was coming. If a trooper's death would benefit the Legion, even in terms of convenience or cost savings, you were as good as dead. Even permadeath was negotiable. Pushing through what amounted to a thicket of fleshy, sticky-leafed flowers was strange enough, but when we reached the lake's edge, we were in for another shock.
"What in the holy hell are those things?"
Carlos asked.
"Fish, I think," Anne answered.
Whatever they were weird. They looked like floating rocks. They had no eyes or fins in sight. These creatures were all over the surface of the water, drifting up to the surface, then down again. They varied in size and markings, from little guys no bigger than my hand, to monsters a full meter in length. At our approach, they moved slowly in our direction.
"They seem to know we're here," I said.
"Maybe the rock look is camouflage."
"You might be right,"
Anne said, standing next to me. She was clearly excited by the find and stared intently as the creatures approached us.
"If they have adopted camouflage, that indicates they must have a predatory species that hunts them."
I nodded, watching the fish.
"They must have some way of sensing us," I said,
"and some kind of limbs underneath that rough-looking top we can see. They remind me a bit of gators in the swamps back home. But they don't have a uniform appearance from one creature to the next."
"Rockfish,"
Carlos said, coming up behind us.
"That's what they are."
"Who asked you?" I demanded.
"I named them first. That's how it works when you discover something. First guy to speak up gets to be famous."
Anne gave him a look, twisting her lips.
"Rockfish. All right. I'll enter it into my logs."
"Make sure you spell my name right,"
Carlos said, crowding close to her.
"Carlos Ortiz. That's with a Z at the end."
"Okay, enough admiring the wildlife," Veteran Harris said, slamming his gauntlets together. "Who's going to kill one and eat it first?"
Everyone looked alarmed. I pointed at Carlos. "He named them. He's the expert here."
"Hold on,"
Carlos protested.
"I don't know what they taste like. They might be poisonous."
"That's right," Harris said, grinning. "But our mission is to find foodstuffs. We're stuck here, remember? You might have saved the entire Legion with your rockfish if we can eat them safely. Now quit being a candy ass and catch one of those things."
Unhappy and complaining, Carlos lowered his faceplate and stepped into the water at a shallow point. The lake became deep quickly. He was up to his knees, only one step out. The rockfish retreated at first, then came gently drifting closer again. They were like ducks, I thought. Ducks at a park that were used to being fed. Harris had a huge grin on his face. He came up behind Carlos and surprised him with a heavy hand on his shoulder. Carlos swayed, and we could hear the servos in his suit whining to keep him steady.
"Hey, careful, vet!"
I felt a bit sorry for Carlos. This sort of thing happened to him all too often. He had a way of making people want to kill him. I was sure everyone in the unit had at least fantasized about doing it. Harris kept his hand on Carlos's shoulder.
"They say the Soupy Lake is over 2 kilometers deep," he told Carlos. "And it goes almost straight down from the edge. You're standing on a little shelf of sand. Did you know that? Now don't step out too far, Ortiz, or you'll sink like a rock in that armor. And you know how I hate to lose a good suit of armor."
"Yeah," Carlos said. "Thanks for the warning. I think for safety's sake, I'll move to the shore."
Nah,
Harris said. He lifted his faceplate and spit into the water. Two rockfish lunged at the spot, then wallowed away disappointedly.
Catch me one. That's an order.
Carlos thought about it, then he did what I probably would have done. He shot one. A hot beam of light flared, and one of the rockfish darkened and began to steam. It swelled up and rolled over. The underbelly was unpleasant. White and wet, it revealed a dozen or so small flippers with little double-jointed arms to work them. We all watched with curling lips and wrinkling noses as the creature shook and hissed. What happened next took us all by surprise, however. The other rockfish lunged at the first one. Mouths appeared at the forward end of each fish, having been concealed just below the waterline. Every one of those mouths was full of triangular teeth that flashed like pearls. They tore apart their cooked comrade, pulling off the shivering fins first, then taking chunks of meat away from the body. The water turned oily and slick on top with dark clouds of blood. Carlos shot another one, and this time reached out to grab it before the others could feast upon its carcass. He lifted the heavy lump of meat, grunting.
"Must weigh 10 kilos, Carlos said. "Vicious little bastards," Harris said in concern. "I bet you're glad you didn't go skinny-dipping, Ortiz."
"Metal armor for the win," Carlos said.
He threw his second catch onto the shoreline where it writhed and smoked. The underbelly was like that of a wet insect.
"Soup's on,"
Carlos shouted enthusiastically, climbing out of the water. No one went near the dying fish, except Anne. In situations like this, bio people were the toughest among us. There didn't seem to be anything that could disgust them. I guess after seeing alien life on a dozen planets, they had pretty strong stomachs.
"The top still looks rock-like, but scorched," Anne said, recording a vid for her report. "The upper layer isn't stone, but rather an encrusted series of wart-like growths. I'm not certain if they've all been generated by the host creature, or if they're parasitic creatures. They might be part of a symbiotic relationship, where the parasites both feed upon the host and provide it with a natural defense at the same time."
She went on like that for quite a while. Whatever the fish was, I was fairly certain I didn't want to eat one after she was done poking, prodding, and measuring it. Except for the big flowers and the weird fish, we didn't encounter any more interesting life forms. We reported all our sightings and were ordered to stay on point at the lakeshore. We grumbled, and as night fell over the world far above, the sunlight that had reflected down the shaft from the surface world slowly died. We'd been in a shady, humid valley before, but as it became darker, the canyon transformed into a clammy hole in the ground, which was exactly what it had been all along, in my opinion. Anne was the only one that seemed fascinated by the place we were in. She dissected her alien fish with gusto. Finally, about 4 hours after we'd caught it, she sat back with a grunt of triumph.
"It'll work," she said. "We'll have to be careful, but we can eat these things. Not the plants, though, only the fish."
Adjunct Leeson came near, and I stood with the two of them, near the mutilated fish.
He said slowly. "What exactly do you mean, we'll have to be careful?"
"Significant portions of the animal are poisonous. It's about the proteins. Truly alien life forms aren't based on the same proteins we're based upon. Organic poisons are essentially proteins, venoms, that kind of thing. This plant has a drastically different ecology, and the life here is based on different chemical building blocks. We'll have to be careful. The main chunk of meat in the central muscle mass, the part that works those small flippers underneath, that's edible. We'll have to drain the blood carefully and strip out all the organs and the cartilage, but we can eat the tail. It'll probably taste good."
Harris came up to join the party.
"Whoa, now, look at that. I've gutted fish before, but you do it right, lady." "Who wants to toast up some of this meat and try it?"
Leeson asked. No one met his eyes, except for Harris, who looked delighted. He'd been wanting to poison one of us since we had arrived.
What are you grinning about, veteran?
I've got the perfect volunteer for you. Carlos Ortiz. He's an avid daredevil.
Adjunct Leeson looked around at the nearby group. His eyes were calculating, and they fell on each of us in turn. I began wishing I'd found somewhere better to be.
Carlos is an ass, Leeson said. But he caught the thing. Grant is a bio, I need her. And she did the job of tearing it up and testing the meat.
Carlos let out a sigh of relief. Harris's face fell in disappointment. Then Harris followed Leeson's gaze, which had now fallen upon me. Harris began grinning again.
An excellent choice, if I may say so myself, sir, he said.
Leeson frowned at Harris.
I need McGill and his heavy tube if those squids show up. Let's see if your gut is as tough as your mouth, veteran.
Harris froze.
What, sir?
You heard me. Eat some fish.
Carlos whooped and banged his gauntlets on his knees. He rushed forward and began preparing the rockfish. Leeson walked away to check the perimeter of our encampment, which filled a crescent of bare land at the edge of the lake.
I think I have a lemon packet somewhere in my rations, Carlos said excitedly. Maybe a little butter, too. I'll fry this right up for you, vet. I'm good at cooking fish.
Get the hell away from that, shouted Harris, kicking him away from the fish. It's my funeral. Let a man die with dignity.
Carlos shut up, but his eyes were shining, while Harris carefully cooked up the fish and tasted tiny bits of it.
What's it like, vet? I asked.
He looked at me, eyes squinting.
Not that bad, really. Kind of like crab, but with less flavor. I don't know. I'd say it tastes like crayfish.
He ate the damn thing. I have to give him that. He didn't just have a taste, either. He ate his fill, consuming a big serving of the white meat.
How long do I have?
He asked biospecialist Grant.
Depends, she said. But if you haven't started puking by morning, I think you're in the clear.
All right, then, he said,
and settled down to sleep. Most of us camped in squads around the lifter. We watched Harris that night. We couldn't help ourselves. Every time he burped or shifted in his sleep, we expected him to vomit blood or something. But by morning, the only reaction anyone could detect was some reddish, itchy spots on his skin.
He's got some kind of plague,
Carlos shouted.
Shut up, Harris growled. Probably just a bug bite.
Let's hope not, said Grant.
She examined him closely. No punctures, no bites.
I'd say it was the fish. You had a slight reaction, but nothing that a little shot of antihistamine can't fix.
We can't eat the fish if we're allergic to it, I said.
We can do a better job preparing it. In this case, we just tore it up and washed it with sterile water. With a little more processing, I think this could be a completely safe food source.
Rockfish, Carlos declared. The new Legion Vera staple. I'm going to come up with some recipes.
You didn't even taste the damn thing, you chicken, Harris told him. Shut up.
Anne worked over Harris as we all watched and ate rations. Secretly, I think most of us were disappointed the veteran didn't at least have a stomachache.
I've had time to do more chemical work on the meat, she said later on. Her expression was grim. I'm detecting about 600 parts per million of domoic acid.
And just what in the nine hells does that mean?
Harris asked. Carlos nudged me excitedly.
He's gonna die, he whispered.
I wasn't so happy about it. If the fish was poisonous, that meant we didn't have a viable food source yet, and we'd failed in one of our primary mission objectives.
Domoic acid is a neurotoxin, Grant said. It's not uncommon on Earth, but it is dangerous. Causes brain damage at high levels over time, and kidney failure at levels 1,000 times lower than this. We can process it out, but it won't be easy.
Harris's face was twisted up into an enraged expression.
What I want to know is how you're going to process it out of me.
Grant shook her head. Your kidneys are trying to flush it out. That's how they get damaged by the toxin. I can give you an injection to help, but it won't be quick.